Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Thibault Papers book study. We're going to go over the book, Harry Thibault, The Collected Writings. And this is the first meeting, and I welcome everybody. And my name's Howard Owen, and I've just read this 4 or 5 times, so Suzanne tapped me to to try to lead this group. So anyway, I wanted to mention that there's a website that I've set up to support this group. And its address, it's at thibault.egbach.com. Thibault is spelled T-I-E-B-O-U-T. And Egbach stands for everything's going to be okay. So E-G-B-O-K.com. And if you go there, there are resources. There will be more resources. Right now, I've got a kind of introductory essay and links to where you can obtain the book. Or the PDF. So, jumping right in, the first two sections of the book are an introduction and a eulogy, really, or a by Bill W. In the Grapevine about Harry Thibault after he died. So, I don't want to read those through, but they do set up important context. So, I want to summarize them. And his resume is basically this man worked hard and long in the field of psychiatry trying to help alcoholics and had limited success. But then in 1939, he became aware of Alcoholics Anonymous through a couple of his patients. One of them was Marty Mann, famous in AA. So the not the first woman to join AA, but the first one to stay continuously sober until she died. And through her, she came in very, very angry and very, very defiant. And he watched her hit bottom and come crawling back and finally accepting AA. So it was his first introduction to the whole process of hitting bottom and surrender. And what really struck him about AA is that people stopped drinking. See, nobody else was getting that. Nobody else could get an alcoholic to stop drinking, and AA could do that. So he was really focused on that, on stopping drinking. That was you can think of him as concentrating on step one. But along with that, he started looking at alcoholics and tried to theorize what the heck was going on, you know, with this hitting bottom thing. And what the psyche of an alcoholic was like, and he formed some opinions about that, and he wrote for a period of at least 20 years. The earliest essay in this book is 1944, and the last one's 1965, so at least 20 years. He wrote for medical journals and gave talks at medical conventions, and also gave several talks at AA conventions and expounded on his ideas. So that's really basically the context in which he's talking mainly in this book to his colleagues, to fellow psychiatrists. And that's an important consideration because it'll explain a lot of what might otherwise be puzzling about this. Then we've got Bill W. giving a really affectionate eulogy to Harry and the Grapevine, and telling the story of Thibault's introduction to AA through Marty and Grenny, and it's definitely worth reading, and sort of you get AA's attitude towards this guy who was on the board for many years until his death, and was a big friend to AA and introduced the ideas of AA to the psychiatric community and did that continuously for a long time. He wrote a lot of papers, not all of which are here, but some important ones are here. So does anybody have any comment on that? Okay, so the first paper is The Role of Psychiatry in the Field of Alcoholism, with comment on the concept of alcoholism as symptom and as disease. Suzanne, can you give me a page number for that?
Yes, I can give you a page number, and it's page 5 in the book, Perry Thibeault, The Collected Writings.
Okay, and it's location 127 on the Kindle, and not applying to the PDF. So, all right, so he's going to develop the ideas of alcoholism as a symptom. The deal is that as psychiatrists had no success with alcoholics, and he's going to look at why he thinks that is, and he himself being a psychiatrist and having no success, he's got some insight to that. And one of the things he thinks is that they weren't taking the drinking seriously, and that what AA does is puts the plug in the jug, and then the rest can come. But the cessation of drinking is essential. So you can look at him as focusing on the first half of step one in this essay. He'll later get into the after the dash and lives became unmanageable part in discussing the psyche of the alcoholic. But this one's step one. So, Suzanne, am I going to read this? Or are we going to have the round robin or what?
So why don't you and I read it?
Okay. All right, so I'll start. Interest in alcoholism is growing rapidly in many directions. This was written in 1949. In many directions, state legislatures have adopted new laws or are considering bills with provisions ranging from investigative commissions to well-established programs of treatment and research. National organizations have sprung up that stress the need for public education and for study of the many issues presented. The police and other correctional agencies are less and less disposed to treat the alcoholic offender as a criminal. They welcome the signs of a more rational approach to the problem. The continued growth of Alcoholics Anonymous has helped to arouse general awareness of the problem and to spread the knowledge that alcoholism is no longer the hopeless scourge that motivated the prohibition experiment. The problem itself looms large statistically on the psychiatric horizon. The data usually cited refer to several million excessive drinkers, among whom at least 750,000 exhibit manifest signs of alcoholic diseases. The number of alcoholics becomes more impressive when compared with the 500,000 known to have tuberculosis, which there was no cure for that at that time. No one can question the overall importance of the problem of alcoholism. Suzanne?
Where does psychiatry fit into the picture? One answer may be derived from a field outside the field of psychiatry. In a pamphlet entitled Principles for Public Action on Problem Drinking, with a subheading, A Guide to Model Legislation, issued in 1947 by the Research Council on Problems of Alcohol, that organization listed 7 principles of action without once using the word psychiatry or psychiatrist. The only reference to the psychiatric side of the problem reads, existing mental hospitals should accept as patients, either directly or by referral from general hospitals, those problem drinkers whose abnormal drinking is purely symptomatic. For example, the psychotic, the feeble-minded, and others. The custodial contribution is all that was recognized. Although the Research Council no longer exists, the deprecation of the role that psychiatry may play in the resolution of the problem of alcoholism presumably survives. It is important because this evaluation arises not from animosity toward psychiatry, but from a belief that psychiatry has too little to offer to merit consideration. That belief rests obviously on the insufficient contribution of psychiatry in this field in the past. The analysis of the reasons for this insufficiency constitutes the main objective of the present communication. Two factors may account for the present state of affairs. First, the peculiar difficulties of the problem of alcoholism have discouraged psychiatrists from studying it with sufficient intensity. Second, the psychiatrists have labored under certain faulty theoretical assumptions that have handicapped them in coming to grips with the practical issues. As to the point, the first point, the alcoholic is a difficult patient for psychiatrists to learn about. If the alcoholic is in an institution, he clamors to get out and usually succeeds since he's not psychotic. If he's at liberty, he seldom maintains a routine treatment relationship. He thus affords few of the usual opportunities for deeper insight. Moreover, as a rule, he seeks help only when prostrated by liquor, and then it is likely to be at such inconvenient hours that he is avoided as not only a most unpromising candidate for therapy, but also an out-and-out nuisance. In consequence, few psychiatrists have had an opportunity to develop a solid body of knowledge concerning the condition. Pass.
The second and perhaps more serious block to formulating an adequate working concept of the condition may be found in certain erroneous assumptions concerning its nature. Although it is frequently stated that alcoholism is a disease, psychiatrists, as a rule, have not really accorded it that status, but have most often held it to be a symptom of some underlying condition that must be uncovered before rational treatment can be instituted. Since the underlying condition is almost always assumed to be one of the already known mental deviations, the psychiatrist, operating on that belief, tends to sidestep the drinking to search for the underlying disease and the causative factors involved in its production. The drinking is merely a sign of depression, of elation, of withdrawal, or some neurotic complication. Anyone who stops to study a symptom is thought to be therapeutically naive and in need of some instruction about first principles. While therapy directed towards the cause of a condition is ideal, total neglect of the symptom may result in ineffective therapy. The symptom itself may assume disease proportions. This may be illustrated by analogy with fever. Nowadays, no one treats a fever. One looks for the causative agent and treats for that, knowing that the fever will subside if the cause can be eradicated. Occasionally, however, the fever gets out of hand and becomes in and of itself a threat to the patient's life. At that point, regardless of cause, the fever itself must be reduced below the level where it threatens life. In the beginning, the fever could be considered a symptom and could be safely ignored as an object of therapy. It may, however, overwhelm the clinical picture, and when it does, it must become the aim of treatment if the patient is to survive. To continue to focus on the cause in the face of the immediate threat to life would be therapeutic folly. Pass.
Another analogy may be cited. Irritation may produce some form of cancer, or to put it differently, cancer may be a reaction to or a symptom of irritation of some sort. Once the cancer process has started, however, removal of the irritation does not stay it. The abnormal growth proceeds unchecked, and it must be attacked directly. In other words, what started as a symptomatic response finally assumes disease significance, and we then treat it as an independent illness. The same thinking is valid for alcoholism. It, too, is a symptom that has taken on disease significance, though starting as a symptom of underlying factors, it gains momentum until it gets out of hand and becomes a disease in itself. To insist on treatment of the original causes is like focusing upon the cause of the life-threatening fever or upon the irritation leading to cancer. The cause and the origins are irrelevant to the immediate danger. One clinical fact supports the conclusion that alcoholism is a symptom that has become a disease. Experience repeatedly proves that no amount of probing and unraveling allows a return to normal drinking. Once the state of alcoholism has supervened, it seems to remove any later possibility of controlled drinking. This new element survives as it were a sensationalized phenomenon sure to be touched off, or sensitized phenomenon soon to be touched off sooner or later if drinking is attempted. The alcoholic always harbors disease potential. Once that potential has come into being, he is forever susceptible. pass?
So he's focusing on step one, you know, and this is because of his clinical experience. The profession of psychiatry could not stop alcoholics from drinking. And Thibault recognized that when AA got people alcoholics put the plug in the jug, it opened up the possibilities for doing therapy, you know, is the way he saw it as a psychiatrist. Or we would think of it as working the program, but in a different way. But his focus is on the drinking here because that is what psychiatry has failed to achieve, and AA was able to achieve. So, going on, further evidence for regarding alcoholism as an illness in and of itself may be seen in the experience of Alcoholics Anonymous. Part of the success of that organization undoubtedly rests upon its simple assumption that alcoholism is a condition to be combated. Undeterred by technical scientific considerations and making no pretense of ferreting out causes, they tackle the alcoholism and succeed more often than they fail. Initially, the stress is entirely upon getting the individual to admit that he is an alcoholic. The first step of their program reads, "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, but our lives have become unmanageable." The speaker at their AA meetings introduces himself and then states, "I am an alcoholic." While it is true they have learned that the way to maintain abstinence is through developing the capacity to live soberly, their earliest efforts are essentially limited to helping the alcoholic accept the fact that he can no longer drink normally and that he can no longer safely take even one drink. This direct approach works, and works efficiently often, to justify the belief that it is founded on one of the fundamental aspects of alcoholism. So there it is in a nutshell. He's impressed by step one. Pass.
If the technique by which the result is affected is examined, it can be seen to resemble a formula that the Alcoholics Anonymous members can follow on a prescription basis, as it were. If they say, "You accept that you are an alcoholic, do this and do that, and you will discover you will not be troubled by a desire to take a drink," instead of an operation to cut out the disease, they have a program that seems to remove the pressure to drink. Concentrating solely on the immediate problem of alcohol and treating the alcoholic's drinking itself as a disease to be eliminated, they seem to have found a remedy for the ailment, alcoholism. Their program, of course, also provides steps for the maintenance of the sobriety once achieved, but the initial steps and the initial emphasis are all upon getting the individual to acknowledge and accept his alcoholism. The simile between cancer and alcoholism may be carried a little further. No one questions the wisdom of operating when a cancer is discovered, even if the irritation that caused it is known. Nor is it held to be therapeutically naive to tackle the emerging symptom directly as an entity needing correction. Regardless of the case, the cancer itself must be removed. Paralleling this, may not alcoholism be considered a disease that emerges from past psychic irritations? The Alcoholics Anonymous program attacking the drinking directly is similar in effect to the operation for cancer. The suspicion of naivete should perhaps be directed towards those who stick to the theoretical assumptions that alcoholism is merely a symptom, and who hold this view in the face of facts that seem to support a different interpretation. One of the chief complaints registered by alcoholics in respect to psychiatrists is that the latter never talk about drinking and seem neither interested nor concerned about its concrete manifestations, sprees and hangovers. The dawning realization of a change in the drinking pattern, the various futile attempts to recapture the former capacity for control, the alcoholic intuitively feels that his drinking is the immediate seat of trouble, and so he waves away the findings of a psychiatrist who calls it merely a symptom. Not until the disease concept is grasped can the psychiatrist really emphasize the alcoholic state of mind as a victim of the condition. Until he does, the psychiatrist will always seem a little remote and talking at cross purposes. the psychiatrist may consider the so-called compulsive element as a crystallization of a disease potential into actuality. With this viewpoint, the problem of alcoholism becomes not only much easier to understand, but also much more responsive to therapeutic efforts. Pass.
In advancing this concept of the nature of alcoholism, there is no thought of denying or belittling the importance of psychotherapy on the deepest possible level. Such therapy, however, must aim at helping the individual to learn to live with his limitation, namely that he cannot drink normally. The alcoholic must be brought to accept that he is the victim of a disease and that the only way for him to remain healthy is to refrain from taking the first drink, that if he attempts to drink moderately, though he may succeed for a time, sooner or later the disease will be rekindled and he will be in trouble again. The job of the therapist is to recognize this inevitable recurrence and to aid his patient in accepting that fact. While the psychotherapy that achieves this may require penetration into the unconscious defiance of hostility toward and rejection of reality, including the inability to drink normally, this tapping of unconscious activity cannot and does not resolve the disease, alcoholism. At best, it helps the patient to live with his limitation. But he's going to expand on that at great length in these papers about this unconscious defiance, hostility toward and rejection of reality as being a key component in the alcoholic psyche. So we have a summary now, and it says, this communication has attempted primarily to enlist the interests of psychiatrists in the study of alcoholism. It was pointed out that neglect on the part of psychiatrists has sometimes produced a reaction of indifference to psychiatric help. It was suggested that study and investigation of the condition had been hampered by inadequate opportunities for close and prolonged contacts. It was also indicated that part of the failure to come to grips with alcoholism lay in faulty assumptions about the nature of the ailment. The concept of alcoholism as a runaway symptom was advanced. Support for this concept was derived first from the empirical fact that once alcoholism is developed, a return to normal drinking is impossible. And secondly, from the results of the efforts of Alcoholics Anonymous, whose program of ignoring the issue of causation and focusing directly on the drinking itself brings that behavior to a complete halt in an impressive percentage of alcoholics. Whether or not these considerations be held clarifying and in agreement with the facts, one primary point seems beyond challenge, that as a group, psychiatrists have not made their weight sufficiently felt in the field of alcoholism. It is to be hoped that they will recognize their responsibility with respect to the problem and put forth the necessary time and effort to enable them to meet that responsibility with wisdom and a growing degree of firsthand knowledge. Okay, so how do we want to proceed, Suzanne?
Why don't we start in with having a discussion? And
okay.
What we can do is go back to the beginning of the chapter. So we want to go back to page 5 or to the first page where it says the role of psychiatry in the field of alcoholism with comment on the concept of alcoholism as symptom and as disease. And does anybody have any comments on that? If you can take a look, just kind of review what we were reading about. And Howard, if you have any comments that you would like to make, please do.
We'll wait to see. Okay, well, to sum up, this is Thibault's lecture to his colleagues, to fellow psychiatrists, about why they're missing the boat with alcoholism. And he knows what he's talking about because he missed the boat for years. He started having success with alcoholics when he saw what was happening in AA, and what really impressed him was the ability to put the plug in the jug. So he's focusing on that here and kind of playing down the follow-on to that, which is, you know, kind of the deeper spiritual change that we talk about in AA. But He's you can look at most of this, most of his writings as being about step one, but he's also doing the after the dash and our lives became unmanageable, and he's going to explain how the alcoholic has a mental disease, that that the disease of alcoholism centers in the mind. But here he's just setting up his colleagues and saying, you have failed, and this looks like it may be a way forward. And that's it in a nutshell. It can be a little bit disconcerting to see things like this tapping of unconscious activity cannot and does not resolve the disease, alcoholism. Well, that's true. I mean, it's like self-knowledge doesn't work, right? So, but there's a tone that says basically once you stop drinking, it's all good. You'll find out later that that's actually not what he's doing. He goes on with therapy, and you know, which isn't going exactly the same direction as the 12 steps. They're divergent, but he does have a notion of follow-on, and he's got, you know, he's going to concentrate on surrender and the defiance of the alcoholic that prevents surrender, and you know, that's a step one topic, but. So that's what I got to say about that.
So this is Suzanne. So I think it's interesting that in the third paragraph he asks where, you know, he just flat out asks where does psychiatry fit into the picture, and then goes on to talk about this pamphlet, Principles for Public Action on Problem Drinking, with a subheading, A Guide to Model Legislation, issued in 1947 by the Research Council on Problems of Alcohol, and that it doesn't use the word psychiatry or psychiatrist. And then he goes on to explain that why that's he doesn't do that, and that is although the Research Council no longer exists, the deprecation of the role that psychiatry may play in the resolution of the problem of alcoholism presumably survive.
Yeah, the bottom line is that the insufficient contribution of psychiatry in this field in the past. Sorry to interrupt. But
no,
that's
no,
the punchline.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
That's the punchline. It's, you know, basically, you know, this pamphlet was issued with no mention of psychiatry, and that, you know, institutions can warehouse these people if they've got mental illnesses, right? So basically it was out of the picture for them. They didn't consider psychiatry. And Thibault says the reason is psychiatry doesn't work the way it's practiced.
Great, thanks. And then when we go over to, that's on page 6, and then on page 7, when he uses the, he starts in talking about how somebody, if they have a fever, and uses an analogy with a fever, and then he goes on to an analogy using cancer. And do you want to, anybody have any comments on that, or do you have any comments on that, Howard?
Wait for people. Okay, so he's telling his colleagues that you got to treat the drinking first. That, like, as if the patient had cancer, you're going to treat the cancer. You're not going to treat the irritation that caused the cancer. Because it's a life and death matter if somebody's drinking, if somebody's wet. You know, and we, you know, the step one is essential to us. You know, you have to do that to get started. So he's telling them that you have to, because what he's done is he has been able to see patients of his stop, which was unique. They didn't do that. They couldn't do that. And the approach that AA took could do it, could get people to put the plug in the jug. Now, you know, permanent sobriety was another matter. But he is taken with that, and he recognizes the importance of that. He says, you know, he thinks that no therapy is going to work unless somebody stops, you know, they stop drinking. So so he's making the analogy with cancer, you know, that cancer is going to kill them, you know, and you may figure out the causes, but it's too late, you know, they're dead. So, you know, alcohol is going to kill the alcoholic. So, you know, that's, and it's working. It's working in his own practice, you know, in conjunction with AA, and you'll see in more detail later what his therapeutic approach is. And it's right along the lines of, you know, hitting bottom and surrendering. So he's repeating that over and over. He's repeating that in this chapter, this paper, that, you know, that you need to treat the symptom in his colleagues' terms. Drinking is a symptom, not the disease. That it's not just a symptom, it's a disease in itself, and it will kill the patient. And you need to do that first. You got to get them to put the plug in the jug first before anything else can happen. And it just restates that several times.
And then I also, like on the last paragraph on page 8, it says that one clinical fact supports the conclusion that alcoholism is a symptom that has become a disease. Experience repeatedly proves that no amount of probing and unraveling allows a return to normal drinking, and we know that. You know, we hear that all the time.
Right.
Once a pickle, you can't go back to being a cucumber.
Mm-hmm.
And once the state of alcoholism has supervened, it seems to remove any latter possibility of controlled drinking. So, and, you know, that... you know, we're really clearly shown in the big book, in the especially I think makes me think of Fred's story when, or maybe it wasn't Fred, it was the person who hadn't he didn't drink for 25 years, and then once he retired, he ended up being dead within 4 years or something like that.
Yeah, putting on his slippers.
Mm-hmm.
Something else occurs to me, which is obvious here, that this is the disease model of alcoholism that Thiebaud is pitching to his colleagues. And it's new. This conception is new. It's novel. So he was one, in fact, of the great proponents of the disease model, and he got it accepted through his efforts and others, but a lot through his efforts. He got the disease theory of alcoholism into the institutional mind of psychiatry and medicine generally. So that's another significance of this.
And then as we continue on and onto in page 9 in the first paragraph, kind of in the middle of the paragraph, is initially, the stress is entirely upon getting the individual to admit that he is an alcoholic. The first step of their program reads, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. And then it goes on to say that when it is true that they have learned that the way to maintain abstinence is through developing the capacity to live soberly, their earliest efforts are essentially limited to helping the alcoholic accept the fact that he can no longer drink normally and that he can no longer safely take even one drink.
That seems accurate to me. I mean, that's the first order of business, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
First step.
And he said it before, too, that his one clinical fact, you know, is that nobody can return to normal drinking. That we can't do it anymore.
Second shoe on the disease.
You know, we know it from an experiential place, and that Dr. Thiebaud was also seeing it from a clinical professional.
Professional.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody have any questions? Or anybody want to bring up anything that we've talked about or anything else that we can talk about? We can continue to go through it page by page. But if anybody has any questions, please.
Yeah,
hi, this is Karen. Oh, go ahead, Lee.
Well, first of all, thank you, Karen. First of all, I was wondering if I heard this right. So basically what he was saying on part of it, I just have two quick things. One part is he was saying that the basically alcoholism was a disease separate on its own. It's not just a symptom, it's a primary disease. Is mm-hmm. that right or not?
Sounds right to me, yeah.
Okay, and secondly, Howard, when you were reading, something that caught me is when you said, and I might have misheard this, but I thought you said that in the reading that it said something about to the effect of getting the alcoholic to basically admit that the drinking's a problem.
All right.
I forgot the exact wording, but what I thought of in my own story is for so long, everything was a problem but the alcohol, you know?
Right.
So I was wondering if that's what he's talking about.
Absolutely, and he's really going to expand on that in the rest of these papers. Is basically, he's going to look at the act of surrender. And what he defines the act of surrender as is surrendering to reality, which is the reality is I can't drink, that the drink is causing my problems. And it's not all the other problems, you know, I go from thinking of alcohol as a solution to my problems to being, you know, a big problem that's the problem I have to deal with. Well, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. I've got to change this.
Okay, so I have one more question, but I'll let Karen and anybody else share first, and then I have one more question before we close.
Hi, this is Karen. Thanks, Lee. Awesome discussion. Thank you, everyone. So, in essence, Dr. Harry's telling these people that we have to take care of this physical thing before we can even take a look at the underlying causes. Is that correct?
Right.
Am I reading that right? Because I know it says it in the book, in our book, in our text, Alcoholics Anonymous, that it's better that a man has to be separated from alcohol and a hospitalization. Like today we have detoxes because in order for us to be able to begin to help them, they have to have the cravings got to be over, basically,
right,
with alcohol. And that's like when we read about Roland Hazard and Dr. Young, you know, Dr. Young told him, I've been trying to get this to happen for you. What a psychiatrist would do, a psychologist would do, you know, trying therapy, and I can't make that happen. So is this, in essence, in this area of this book, is Dr. Harry explaining that to his colleagues that this is why you're not having any success, because we have to arrest this acute situation first?
That's what he's doing. And he's talking about, to his colleagues, saying that finding the underlying motivations, and, you know, that's not the same thing as coming to a spiritual awakening in my book. You know, that's an intellectual approach that you see what in your character, and really it's what Thibault's going to do for the rest of this. This is all pretty intellectual, but, you know, we're missing the spiritual component, although I'll point out later where he acknowledges that.
Right.
But you know, he's saying to his colleagues that this analysis of the deep character that is causing the alcoholism doesn't work. It doesn't work to get people to stop drinking, and it doesn't work to keep people stopped, right?
No.
No amount of introspection, I'm paraphrasing, no amount of, you know, deep psychiatry prevents an alcoholic from going on a spree after they take the first drink. So, yeah, it's exactly what you said.
Well, when he's comparing alcoholism to cancer, this is an amazing thing and a huge tool that when I'm working with somebody, I try to explain that, you know, like I myself have cancer in remission, and I've been in remission for a long time. I also have alcoholism in remission because I'm sober and I'm clean and I'm recovered. And so, but we have to put alcoholism in remission before we can do this deeper work, that forced, you know, when it tells us that we recover from a hopeless state of mind and body, what it says in our textbook, I believe that what he's trying to explain to them is this has to happen before you can do anything else. You've got to take this acute situation and arrest it and put it in remission. Does that make sense?
Yes, totally. That's the message.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for letting me share that. And thank you for all that you're doing.
Oh, you're welcome. Having fun. So, Lee, did you have another question?
Well, you answered it during your talk with Karen. So, but thank, and I want to thank you, Howard, for what you're doing, you and Suzanne both, so, and everybody else is participating.
I'm really having a ball, but thank you.
You're welcome.
Does anybody else have questions?
This is Bob, alcoholic.
Bob?
Hey, Howard, thank you. I don't really have a question, but I have a couple of points that kind of jumped out at me. And it seems to be a different usage of the two key words that we learn about between Dr. Thibault, coming from the psychiatrist's point of view, and the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that, to me, is the use of the word alcoholism, as opposed to when he says that the problem of drinking too much is the disease of alcoholism. What I've learned in the big book is that the problem of drinking too much is alcohol, that the underlying disease of my spiritual unmanageability is the disease of alcoholism. And here when he says when it gets too much and someone's drinking way too much, they get the disease of alcoholism. From the big book, I've learned that the disease of alcoholism probably predated the point of drinking too much. And they talk about here, one thing he's talking about psychiatrically is I want to get back to the page. So once they get to this point, the psychiatrist, it says here on page 6, since the underlying condition is almost always assumed to be one of the already known mental deviations, the psychiatrist tends to sidestep the drinking to search for the underlying disease and the causative factors. So that's okay, except then he says the drinking is merely a sign of depression, of elation, of withdrawal, or some neurotic complication. I think, to me, what the problem for the psychiatrists and their training was back then, and maybe even still to some of them, is that if you look, in the DSM, there's no classification for spiritual unmanageability. There's no psychiatric diagnosis of that.
Right.
So
psychiatry doesn't give us that.
Excuse me?
Psychiatry doesn't give us that.
Right. But that's really what the problem of the alcoholic is, according to the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't talk about psychiatric diagnoses of depression or anything else. They talk about that we need to have a profound spiritual change, a shift in perception, which comes about by fixing our spiritual unmanageabilities and our spiritual condition.
Yes.
So, the psychiatrists back then, if they didn't understand that, how could they treat something they don't even know about and they don't even understand?
Yep.
And I think that was one of their big frustrations. I think that's what the psychiatrist was telling Roland Hazard, when he was over there, that there's just psychiatrically, they have no way to treat it, even if they get you to stop drinking. Because that's what gets us to drink. And that's what I was understood is the disease of alcoholism. The other thing that jumped out at me on page 10, you know, he was talking about how the psychiatrist can't seem to get through to the patient. And to me that just pointed out what they tell us throughout the first step and then working with others is that, you know, for someone to listen to try to get into this program and to follow what those who have gone before him, the message has to come from someone with depth and weight and experience. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's what Dr. Silkworth realized, and that's what he told Bill. He said, just go tell him your story.
Mm-hmm.
And if people identify, then they're more apt to listen, and the light goes off and goes, well, if that guy had what I have, maybe he knows what he's talking about. And if that guy found a way to get better, maybe I can too.
Yep.
I mean, I know in my experience, really psychiatrists, more psychologists, but I mean, if they started to talk about any of this stuff, it had no impact on me whatsoever.
Yep.
And it wasn't until I heard from people that really had experienced it that led me to realize, that set off a light in, you know, in my brain, that they have a solution and it's worked for them. And I've, you know, it's all we often say, and I said this too. When I was not drinking, but still not, you know, happy, joyous, and free, I looked at the people around me who were, and I went to them and asked them who their sponsor was.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and did what they did. And that to me, you know, carried much more weight than any doctor, including my own, would tell me. Throughout the years I was drinking. Thank you.
Yeah. So this book isn't about, you know, the program of spiritual action in the book. It's a physician looking at the results of Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to explain it in his own terms and trying to explain it to his colleagues. So he's going to miss a lot. He's going to miss most of what you said. But he is an insightful fellow, and what he's going to be able to do is look at the character of an alcoholic. And this is all intellectual stuff. This will not keep me sober. But it's good information to know, you know, to identify with what Thibault says when he starts talking about the alcoholic ego. And, you know, I get benefit from that. I'm not going to stay sober on that. You know, I have to have a spiritual solution for the problem that Thibault describes. Okay, so what I take away from this is not how to get sober, but how my alcoholic mind works, which is important information for me.
Right, well, what he doesn't talk about here, maybe he does later, is how he does talk about the part about where we have, you know, an alcoholic can't take the any drinks at all, can't take the first drink.
Right.
But what he didn't mention, at least in this section, is how the main problem centers in the mind, and to stay stopped, you got to do something about the mental obsession.
Yeah, well, he'll talk about that.
He'll
definitely talk about that. As a psychiatrist, that's going to be his stance towards this.
Okay. Thanks.
Hey, Howard, this is Karen again. Bobby, you know what? In this part of this writing, in this one paper, he's not talking to us. He's talking to his colleagues, and what he's trying to say to them is first things first. You can't do anything with these people until they've been separated from alcohol, and that's the biggest problem, is to deal with that first. And he's trying to explain what he's seen in that aspect, that that's the before an alcoholic can actually even absorb anything that's going on and learn. Before we can learn about ourselves, we've got to get this stuff out of our systems and do it safely. And then, and this is like the only thing really that I've seen that he's really dealing with in this paper, is that this is the very first rung of the ladder, because because I've read all of this stuff, for a lot, and I know how deep he goes in the later chapters and the later papers. But I really think that, because I agree with everything you say, Bobby, because this is what we know. But these guys, you're talking about a bunch of people with, like, rocket scientists and beyond IQs. They're not going to get that. You know what I mean? So I feel like he was trying to take his colleagues through this, like, climb this one rung at a time. I don't know if that makes sense, Howard, but that's what I feel like he was doing in this initial paper.
Yeah, I feel like he's actually doing that throughout this. He's talking to his colleagues in most of these. There's three of the stories. Two appeared in the Grapevine, and one was a talk before the 1955 convention, I think. It was before some convention. Anyway, those were pitched at Alcoholics. But most of these papers appeared in scholarly journals. And it's actually one of the difficulties of reading Tebow is that he uses psychiatric jargon. And it's psychiatric jargon in talking about the way psychiatry was in the 50s, which has changed considerably since then. So it can be difficult to understand him for that, but it's important to remember that that's where he's pitching this. And he's not telling me how to stay sober. He's telling his colleagues that, hey, here's a better way to treat this. And, in point of fact, getting people to stop drinking, the step one is the first step. And he was able to achieve that. He couldn't, people had to go to AA to stay sober, but he analyzed what was going through an alcoholic's mind. Basically, to preview this, you got this defiance, this defiant ego that basically says, the world is as it is, and it's as I want it to be, and I'm not going to see anything else. I'm going to see what I believe, and my life is going down in ruin around me, and it's all your fault. And I'm going to, and there's this alcoholic ego that has to be smashed, and it happens in step one. So, that's the psychological view of surrender. That's not a complete view of surrender, but it's a psychiatric view. So, I take away from this that it's what it's worth. It's a psychiatric approach. I know that's not enough to keep me sober, but I value the insights. Some of that I don't agree with. Some of that I put aside. But, his constant harping on it being a symptom only gets a little old for me. But he actually does move on and try to look at causes and conditions a little bit. And he downplays the spiritual angle, but if you go on that website, I've got a link about halfway through the essay, or it's also on the Obtaining the Book page, to a talk that he gave at the 1955 International Convention, in which he acknowledges the spiritual side and embraces it. Go ahead.
Sorry, this is Bob again. Uh-huh. I have a question, and if you don't want to give away the answer yet, that's okay, because mm-hmm. what I'm wondering is, at the end of all this, does Dr. Tebow think that psychiatrists can treat alcoholics, or does Dr. Tebow say you got to send them to AA?
I think it's both. Basically, he used AA in conjunction with his therapy. So his results may not be due to his psychotherapy, right? So he believed it did, and he'll talk about some of his clinical experience. But it's in conjunction with AA. So he's on board with AA's therapy from his point of view, right? Psychiatric mm-hmm. point. So, I don't think he has the hubris to believe that he's got the whole answer. He was a humble guy in a lot of ways. If you read that eulogy by Bill W., you'll see that he credits him with a great deal of humility. So.
Okay. Thanks.
You bet.
Howard.
Yo.
This is Lee again. What was that website?
Okay, that's HTTP. It's tebout.egbot.com. So TIEBOUT period, EGBOK stands for everything's going to be okay, EGBOK.com.
So E-T-G-B-O-K?
E-G-B-O-K. So everything's gonna be okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Howard, this is Karen again. I just wanted mm-hmm. to, you know, address one of Bobby's concerns again when he was talking about alcoholism, you know, the disease. You know what? In our book, in our text, it says at a certain point, and this is on page 24, in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail.
Right.
And I believe that's what he was talking about, where our drinking will absolutely become this. Like when we pass over that stage of the point of no return, I think mm-hmm. that maybe he was trying to explain that to his colleagues as well. And it comes out mm-hmm. kind of, it's a little convoluted for us because we know about recovery and we know what we needed. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why, like, this stuff, like, makes me bristle a little when I read it, because I want to say, you guys don't even know what you're talking about because yeah. of what we've been right. through. So maybe yeah. that's what was happening with Bobby, because I'm feeling the same way. I'm like, wait a minute. But
no, absolutely.
I think that's what
I get
was going to say. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because Tebow wasn't drinking. Tebow didn't know what it was like to be an alcoholic. But he was a perceptive observer. And from his perspective as a psychiatrist, which is different
right.
from a member of AA, right? From his perspective, he was able to, in my opinion, he was able to see some things that are valuable, you know, in conjunction, certainly not in place of, but in conjunction with a spiritual program of action, it helps me to know that my ego works a certain way. You know, and I don't buy everything he says about the ego, but boy, do I recognize a lot of it. You know, and yet my job is to give that away to God, is to let God in and the ego out. You know, and that's my spiritual path. So he's talking about the nature of that ego. The psychological nature of that ego.
Right.
It's useful. You know.
Oh yeah. Well, he's the one that brought this to Silkworth. Our people were relapsing like crazy because of the rebuilding of the ego. Because all of a sudden we're like resting on our laurels because that's what the right. nature of the beast. And he's
yep.
the one that went to Dr. Silkworth and said, "Hey, you got a problem," and here it is.
Yeah.
I believe that. I believe that. I know his work really helped me a lot. So.
Yeah.
So I just want to ask if Stephanie or Terry, do you have any comments that you'd like to make?
Hi, Susan, it's Terry. I don't have any comments. I can't wait to get the book so I can really follow along better. But I did want to thank Howard for all the information. It's really good, a lot. But it's very interesting. And, again, I can't wait to get the book on its way.
Great.
You're welcome.
Hi, this is Stephanie. I don't have any comments either, but I'm looking forward to doing more of the study.
Great. And does anybody have anything before we wrap up that they want to share? Okay, so for our next meeting or session or workshop, Howard, do you want to let us know what we'll be looking at so that we can take a look at it ahead of time?
The next paper is long. We may not be able to cover it all in the next session, but... It's an important one. I don't know exactly where we'll break in terms of time, but it would be good to read the whole thing. That's what I'm going to do, if only to find the timing. But it's longer than the one we just did, so and needy. It's got a lot of stuff, talking about surrender. And he starts talking about the alcoholic ego in this one.
And this is The Art of Surrender in the Therapeutic Process with special reference to alcoholism?
Yep.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very, very much. And thank everybody for being here. And I'm going to stop the recording.
Okay.